Welcome to Lecture 5 of the Your Five Faces of God lecture series. This lecture is entitled Metal. The organs of metal are the lung and large intestine, the emotion is grief, and the virtue is justice. This lecture is about the metal element, and as I mentioned in the intro, the emotion of the metal element is grief, and when used well, it helps us to appreciate divine justice and have righteous behavior. When grief is imbalanced, we tend to either addictions and obsessive behavior, or frailty and weakness. The outline of the lecture is that I'll go first through the nature and the role of metal, and then I'll discuss, in context of that, the nature of grief, and why grief is necessary for renewal. The virtue of justice in detail, after we talk about grief, and then I'll go into more detail about the distortion of addiction and why that's a distortion of the proper grieving process, and also the distortion of weakness or frailty. The metal officials are the organs associated with metal, and that's the lung. The lung can be considered the judge, the minister who issues policies. And then the large intestine helps the lung do its job, and its job could be called the Minister of Sanitation. We'll go through the lung in a little bit more detail and talk about some of its specific functions and how that informs our perspective on grief and justice, and how the primary role of the lungs then is to acquire things of value or acquire value in our lives. And the large intestine, when we go through its functions, we'll see how that applies to this emotion, and that its function is releasing the impure. And we'll go through the cooperation between the two, but that is overall the theme of metal, is that we have to decide what is of value in life and what we should carry forward with us and what we should leave behind as no longer serving our journey. And then finally, I'll go through some common beliefs around grief that keep us from processing grief well and gracefully, and that lead us to more purity of mind and soul and behavior. The nature of metal is that it represents a return to our origins. One of the metaphors of the five element theory is the idea of the seasons, and in that wood represents the spring and the beginning of growth and the initiation of growth towards a greater state of awareness. Fire then represents an expansion of that awareness or the full expansion of it. But then and that corresponds, of course, to the summer and to the maximum growth and harvest. And then metal corresponds to the fall and the idea of contracting back to our roots and to the earth and to our primal origins. So the proper sense of this is that it is a cyclic activity, and rather than being just a one-time thing, we're born, we live, we die, that there is a cyclic process in our life of initiating growth, achieving some kind of growth and having an expanded awareness and joy out of that, and then contracting and releasing what's no longer serves from our new state of awareness and our new condition, and so that we can then become again renewed. So in that sense, fall is the contraction towards the core and the core of our experience after the growth and expansion of spring and summer. It does represent death, as I said, but it also represents the death of a phase of growth where we prepare for renewal by shedding what is unessential for our next phase of growth. Now, the character for the metal element in Chinese depicts a roof covering a mineshaft containing two nuggets of gold, gold being the most precious of metals and represents the goal of spiritual transformation, to find the gold within. But having it being in the mineshaft implies that you have to sift through a lot of dirt and you have to do a lot of digging to get to what's really, truly pure and truly of value. And then the dirt needs to be discarded, or more accurately, return to the earth. So this is one of the images of metal, is searching for that which is of value and retaining it, and then releasing back to the earth that which is of really is just ordinary and not worth carrying forward with you. One of the things about metal is that metal has the ability to be molded into any shape and represents our ability to become clear and focused in our awareness. Water also will conform to a shape, but it doesn't hold a shape. Metal can hold that shape and become something lasting and permanent. So skill and tenacity are required to take a formless lump of metal and pound it into a fine-edged sword or knife. This transformation is not achieved all at one time. The master swordsmith will reheat, fold, and re-beat the metal to remove impurities and to create an alignment of structure that gives superior strength. And so this is part of the imagery of why this element is called metal, because there is this strong analogy to the idea of successive purification and successive alignment towards a particular purpose or destiny. And so a bit of metal has no destiny until it is actually beaten into shape. And that is actually the idea of metal, is a rhythmic transformative process of becoming more and more pure in our essence. So to achieve clarity of purpose, we must eliminate impurities. And this is a process of discarding that which is impure. And it is, in addition to the rhythm of the seasons, there's this rhythm of growth and decline and then rebirth. Metal also rules the breath because it's associated with the lungs. So each exhalation is releasing our contact with the world, surrendering the previous moment in trust that another breath is on its way. In the next inhalation, our connection to the world or the Tao is restored. And so the higher ideal of metal is, and hence of the breath, is that if we completely surrender our breath, we don't hold anything back. We don't hold on to any bit of our breath. We completely surrender it. And with that, we completely surrender our life, because we can live only a very short amount of time without breath. We can live a long time without food. We can live a long time without water. But we can live an extremely short time without breath. And so to surrender that most precious commodity, our breath, is an act of faith, of trusting that we will come back. And so the full exhalation is actually a death to the previous moment, which is then a commitment to experience the next moment fresh. In our journey towards wisdom and purity, we need to continually assess then what we have gained in the previous period and what will help us in our evolution. Retaining what is of value and releasing back to the earth what is not of value is the theme of metal. By honoring the value we have received, we honor our own self-worth. Metal then asks the question, is this of value? Put another way, metal asks, is this of value for me and the next phase of my growth? Or does this add value to my life? And so this is a different way of looking at the emotion of grief than we're used to. Commonly, people consider that grief is just crying and don't analyze it much further. And crying's uncomfortable, so let's try to shorten the time as much as possible. But really, the nature of grief is dissolving and releasing that which is no longer appropriate. And in the context of grieving, and when particularly when we're grieving an identifiable loss, such as the death of a loved one or a pet or having moved away from the city you grew up in, or anything where there is a sense of loss, what's no longer appropriate is to have the expectation of having that person, that house, that pet, that job, that city in your life in the future. Really, it's our behavior patterns of expectation that need to shift. So attachment to people, things, or situation produces longing or yearning, a desire to still have that item or still have that person in our lives. And this yearning or longing makes the grieving process painful and difficult as in order to go through the grieving, we have to contact everything about that situation in order to perceive the continuing value. So the idea is that if we, for instance, are grieving the death of somebody, then really to see what is useful for us, we have to really expose our awareness to our whole experience of that person, and that may be a long-term relationship. And what's not useful is the expectation you're going to see them, and so that should be released. But what you've learned from that person, the lessons, the joy and the happy memories, those are worth retaining. And so this is the sorting out process, the sifting through the whole mine shaft to find out what is the nugget that's going to serve you going forward, and then what is actually needs to be discarded so that it does not essentially clutter your mind up with things that aren't really going to happen. Our beliefs about the nature of life and ourselves get in the way of this process. So, grief is often said to have five phases, and you've probably heard of this, but the five phases of grief that many people talk about in psychology is: stage one is denial and numbness. Stage two is anger and blame. Stage three is bargaining and deal-making with God. Stage four is grieving and crying. And stage five is finally acceptance and gratitude. Now, you know, to point out, only one of those four phases or five phases is actually grieving. Step four is where the actual grieving takes place. All of the other activities are other activities. And so really, the idea of denial and numbness is an inability to accept that the universe gives and the universe takes. And so if there has to be a delay before you can process the loss, and there's just a sense of denial. And this is not uncommon to see in people. They've suffered a terrible loss, and they just don't seem to be very emotional about it. They're like, oh, well, you know, it's okay, and I'm fine, and they're just pressing on with things without taking any time to actually get in touch with their emotions. And of course, it's not okay, and it's not fine. They've lost somebody precious to them. And so that phase of appearing fine, and some people can go through quite a long period of that, and it might be to get through the funeral, and it might be to get through the first few months, and some people can keep that denial going up for years. But it's actually just avoiding going through the processing. Another stage is to partially accept the idea that the person is gone, or that the situation has gone, and that there has been a loss. But rather than just accepting it as reality, there's a need to try to explain it away by assigning blame. You know, the blame may be to oneself or to somebody else. I've had many situations in talking about somebody who has suffered a loss, and they spend an inordinate amount of time second-guessing all the medical decisions that were made, and second-guessing whether or not they should have insisted on a certain type of care for their loved one, or which is then blaming themselves, or focusing blame on the doctors who did the wrong thing or were incompetent or some other excuse for why the person died. And the bottom line is, not to say that mistakes don't happen, and that in hindsight we might rethink our decisions and think we might have done it differently, but to spend energy on the blame game does not bring the person back, and it only delays the actual process of grieving. But this is very common, and And depending on the person's other aspects of the person's personality, they'll spend a long time either blaming themselves, blaming somebody else, such as the doctor, and in many cases, actually being angry and blaming the person who passed away and feeling abandoned by that person and actually taking it personally. That, you know, how dare my wife of 30 years die? Didn't she know that I needed her? And this perception may or may not be fully conscious, but in some cases it really is, that there's an anger towards the person who left. It's like, well, they chose to go, and that, you know, how dare they, you know, choose abandoning me. And it doesn't really get into the process of grieving. So the bargaining and deal-making, I often consider this deal-making with God. So there's some intuitive sense that really it's divine will, or the will of collective consciousness, that is actually a larger operating factor than our own personal will in the events of the universe. That things happen, stuff happens. And so, but when we're always looking for an explanation of it, we're always looking for a way to make a deal. And so perhaps the person is grieving their own life in advance of dying because they've been told that they have cancer and that it's terminal. And so then maybe they start bargaining as that, okay, what I'll do is I'll stop smoking, and then that will get rid of the cancer. And it may be more formal, is that they pray to God that if I do this, will you take away my cancer? Or if I promise to be a good person and to stop doing some particular behavior that they're not proud of, will you bring my little boy back? And so this kind of expectation that there's some way to make it all okay, some magic thing that could happen, that you could actually just have the right thought or look quickly enough and see that person again, is a kind of bargaining or deal making. So that also takes a lot of effort and delays the actual process of grieving. So then when there's an actual appreciation of the fact that, you know what, they're gone and I have to cry now, you know, that's when the grieving process actually begins in earnest. And you know, I'm discussing these as linear phases, but of course not everybody goes through all these phases. They may not go through the bargaining phase, although it's common, and they may get into the grieving and then be uncomfortable with the process of grieving and find it too painful. And so then they retreat back to the anger or denial phase and either numb out and, you know, deny that they need to grieve, or go back to the whole argument of who's to blame and who's at fault and who can I hold responsible for this, and not really accepting the reality that holding somebody responsible still doesn't bring the person or the situation back. So being able to appreciate that you can keep the memory of something or someone, and the wisdom and the gifts of the experience of having them in your life, helps to stay focused on the task of dissolving expectations. Because that's what the grief is about, is to stop expecting to see that person in everyday life, but to not deny what they brought to your life. And so actually, in some sense, the eyes towards the future of being able to have processed the loss and done the crying, and then still be able to retain the value that person brought to your life, you know, that's the goal of the grieving, is to retain the value and then dissolve the expectations of seeing them again, and also to dissolve some of the memories of their death, if that was a painful experience, if it was a traumatic or sudden experience that that was perceived to be terrible in some way, that is not something you really want to linger and focus on. It's how that person enriched your life is, and how they shaped your perspective and how they helped you grow. Those are the things that are of value to be retained. So then, to summarize that, dissolving habits and behavior patterns is the function of grief. Not to erase all memory of the person or all memory of that experience or that life phase. This would be counterproductive, as we could not continue to grow without retaining the essence of those encounters. And that is our virtue from the wood element, is to stay true to our destiny of growth and always becoming more pure and more godlike, more heavenlike in our actions and our attitudes and our behaviors. And we can't move towards that goal without both retaining the valuable things we've learned and releasing the things that are really the non-valuable aspects of the experience. So now we'll cover this in more detail further on, but the large intestine is part of the metal element, and of course its job is to release the byproduct of digestion. We're supposed to absorb the nutrients and the energy out of our food, and then the fiber we're supposed to pass on and return to the earth for more renewal. And so the same with our experience. We're supposed to glean the positive value out of all of our experiences, and then the emotional fiber, if you will, should be released and returned to the earth. So this process of contacting everything there is in our memory about that phase of life or that person or that animal, and then discerning what is of continuing value, and then dissolving the attachment so to the things that should be discarded, is the process of actual grieving. Now, one of the things we'll talk about more later in under the belief systems is that the things that get in the way of grieving are our expectations. We all have some expectation that things will pass from our lives. We're just often not ready for it to happen at the time that it does. But even within that, there's relative acceptance of certain kinds of loss. You know, for instance, most people expect to bury their parents, is that they anticipate that their parents will live longer than they do. Now, we still have preconceived notions about how long is a long life. And so even though at some level we expect that our parents will die before us, then, you know, if they die young, in their 40s or their 50s, we feel a bit robbed and cheated, and there's a resistance to actually accepting and processing the death. Whereas if a parent dies in their 80s or 90s, we're more likely to accept the idea that they've had a good, fair allocation of life, and that this is more of a natural process. The grieving still has to happen, but the resistance to grieving is likely to be less when it fits your expectations. So I remember in my own life, I had a situation some years ago where my favorite dog died, and it was fairly suddenly, but nonetheless, it was a breed that usually only lives to be about 10 or 11 years, and this dog was almost 13, and she went really quickly, and I cried intensely for a day, but it was because the situation was not outside of my expectations. I felt like I was able to grieve very quickly and very cleanly, and although I still remember the dog and I remember how much that dog enriched my life, I've forgotten, unless I effort, I've forgotten the experience of her death. And more importantly is that I would always look for the dog in the yard to make sure the dog was around and hadn't gone off to attack the neighbor's chickens or something like that. I was trying to be a responsible dog owner. And as soon as I fully finished my grieving process, I never ever looked for the dog again. And so that was to me, a successful completion of actually processing my grief. So, but you know, it's not just animals. I remember many years ago when I was living in Hawaii, when I started my career in oriental bodywork, I had my private practice and I also had a job working in a resort spa, and one of the top resort spas in Hawaii, in an incredibly beautiful setting, and giving massages on the beach in a cabana overlooking the water. And so doing massage, watching the sunset, watching the dolphins leap, watching the whales and the turtles, and really quite a difficult place to leave. When my career progressed to the point where it really was time for me to leave a resort spa and focus on my further development in my career, it was difficult. And I found an excuse to quit over a scheduling issue, and that I was unwilling to be as available as they wanted me to be, which was a rule. And so I said, fine, well, then I quit. And what was interesting is I walked out and cleaned out my employee locker and walked out, and absolutely nothing happened to me. And then a day later, I get a call from my boss saying that the director of human resources had torn up my resignation letter and said, break the rules, let Kaimi stay working. So that actually happened twice over different incidents, and where I was not resolved to actually leave, I was semi-resolved, and I made my leaving conditional upon a certain issue. And both times the issue was resolved, my resignation was torn up, and both times I walked out the door and nothing happened. And then finally I was clear that it was time to move on, and that I could retain the experience I'd gained in that environment, and the friends I'd made, and the connections with people from all around the world. And I gave my letter in. My boss looked me in the eye and said, oh, you mean it this time? And I walked out the door and cried. And because it had been a fabulous experience working there, and really quite a gift to have in my life. And what was interesting was that for all the years that I'd been working at that resort, every time I had driven by the resort on the highway, I would turn into the resort, even if I was intending to go past the resort to the shopping center down the highway a piece. And it was very difficult to actually just drive past the resort without turning in, because that was my habit. And it was kind of an autopilot kind of thing, and I had to exert a lot of effort not to do it. Once I actually cried, I never mistakenly turned into the resort again. I just was able to go about my business, so to speak. So, now, those were experiences that were easy to grieve. I did some years ago suffer a loss of a family member who I did not expect to die, who was just a child, and did not fit my expectations. And then all of my resistances to, this isn't right and this is not how the universe is supposed to work, rose up to block my process of grieving. I still cried, but I kept vacillating between the actual grieving and going back to second-guessing the situation, and what if this and what if that and what if we'd done this and what if we'd done that, and all of which actually denies the acceptance that actually this is what's happened and I need to process it and move on. So the other idea around this idea of proper grief is the idea, really coming back to the idea of what is of value and what to retain versus what is not what you want to focus on and not what you want to retain. So in order to see the value, you must let go of the things which don't serve you anymore. Now, I've given the example of letting go of the expectation of seeing the person again, but it can also be focusing on the wrong aspects of somebody's life. And I remember watching a television show on Oprah, and Oprah had her favorite psychologist, Dr. Phil, on, counseling a woman who had been for years just lost in grief over her daughter who had been murdered, and obviously a very difficult thing to accept. And she was just unable to even get through a sentence without crying and losing all sense of control. And Dr. Phil asked her and he said, would you think your daughter would want you to focus all of your attention only on the last day of her life and forget all of the positive contribution she gave you and all of the joy and all of the memories that you have? Do you think that's honoring her memory to focus only on the very last day? And it was well said and well put, and it just stopped the woman in her tracks and said, oh my goodness, I've never thought of it that way. You're right. I'm completely denying her life by obsessing over her death. And so, to me, that's a great example of understanding what is the proper role of grief, is that we cannot retain the nuggets or the pearls without discarding the stuff that isn't useful to carry forward. So in essence, then, grief asks, should I let this go? And dissolves our attachment to what is no longer useful. The process includes actually sifting through all of the related experiences to see which ones do need to be retained, to find the nuggets of gold buried in the non-essential things which need to be discarded. Now that brings us to the virtue of justice. Justice describes the ability to judge value and act fairly and appropriately. A judge should be able to detach himself from his emotions and weigh the facts to determine an appropriate course of action. A judge cannot be distracted by desiring a different state of affairs and to allow his own thoughts of what should have happened to cloud his judgment. He must decide on the situation at hand. Being able to accept the reality of the situation really equates to being able to accept divine will. Embracing the current situation as something that has happened according to collective consciousness or God or divine will gives the acceptance necessary to face the grieving process openly. This is tied to the breath, as our ability to accept life is related to our ability to inhale, and our ability to surrender control of the world is related to our ability to exhale. So control is a metal issue as well as a fire issue. This represents an inability to accept divine will and to hold on to the gains of the past without trusting the universe to provide more value and more joy in the future. Holding on takes us away from righteousness, and righteousness here is really another word for the virtue of justice, is to see what is actually appropriate in this moment. And to do that, we have to be in the moment. We can't be overly directed towards the future or holding on to the past. So holding on to anything from the past really takes us away from righteousness, because it increases our concern for our personal gains and our personal losses. You know, I lived in Hawaii for many years, and in Hawaiian, the word for breath is ha, which is interesting, as you make the sound ha by exhaling. And that is the act of letting go. My understanding of the actual translation of ha is that it doesn't just mean breath. It literally means the breath of God. And so this is really just implied in the language and in the understanding, is that every breath you take is a divine gift. But if you try just breathing in and never breathing out, well, technically that's asthma. The inability to breathe out is a form of asthma. But it's really, it precludes you from being able to take another breath in. So until we release the gift of a moment ago, we cannot accept another gift. And so this idea that the breath is what connects you to God is implicit in that language, and the idea of saying that breath means breath of God really respects the idea of life force as being something we truly do not understand. We've studied physiology for hundreds of years, and we know lots about it, and we know the names of all the amino acids, but we still can't make a human from scratch. So we can't even build a cell and make it live, let alone make a whole human or a whole animal and then imbue it with breath. And so this, if we can't recreate it, then the phenomenon of breath must be beyond our understanding, and it has to be divine in nature. And that's really the idea of respecting the breath, is that every breath is sacred, every breath is a gift. So this idea of holding the breath keeps you from breathing in, is that actually not being able to exhale is to the way to actually shorten the amount of time that you're disconnected from God, is to actually exhale completely. Ha. And then that ha is actually saying, in essence, the name of God. And then there's just a momentary delay before your connection is restored with life-giving breath. The irony for metal and for grief is, and this inability in many people to let go of what's no longer essential, is that the things of most value are the things that aren't substantial. So the essence of something or someone lives on in how it has shaped and formed our personality. You know, often, you know, to comfort somebody going through grief, we'll say, well, they're not really gone because they live on in your heart. And so they can, in terms of our personality or our shen, is actually stored in the heart. And to the extent that we have contacted somebody and we have gained value in how our life perception has evolved, and we've shaped our personality through that contact, and then we have that memory and that gratitude towards that person for sharing their life with us, then that does live on in the heart and in our personality. But we can only be in touch with that if we release the expectation of daily interaction. Not holding on to that which is no longer useful or appropriate makes us more open to receiving something else of value, and that makes us more alive. So people who actually breathe out all the way and surrender that which is no longer theirs to keep are actually more present, more dynamic, and more inspiring. So with that, let me give a few more words for talking about different aspects of this virtue of justice, because justice can seem a little bit abstract. The idea of righteousness and really clear, appropriate, upright behavior, where we are actually behaving in a way that we can be proud of. So having a balance in our lives, that we do behave appropriately, that we don't have, like in the earth element, over-concern for our needs versus somebody else's. Part of that ability of the earth to have integrity actually comes from the metal's ability to be in balance with the balance of give and take in life, and to not obsess over the taking, but to also acknowledge the giving and to acknowledge them equally. So letting go makes us actually more receptive. So people who let go of the past and let go of grudges and let go of situations are more receptive people. They're more approachable people. They're more inspired, and they're more inspiring. They can be more impartial and more detached from losing focus and losing clarity on a situation. Or having more neutrality is another way of saying that. So to summarize then, justice is the virtue of accepting that life is give and take, and that we must stay focused on the moving forward aspect of life, and appreciating and retaining the value present in this moment in order for our own life to have meaning and purpose. It is remembering that breath is what can reconnect us to our divine spirit. And this is actually why all monastic traditions begin the day during lung time with prayers and chants and breathing exercises to affirm the gift of life. So somebody who is living the life of a monk, their goal is to be pure in their hearts and closer to God. And the acknowledged wisdom is that if you're going to do that, then you better spend some time really focusing on your ability to breathe early in the morning, between 3 and 5 in the morning, which is the time of the lung meridian. And so, and it is interesting, is that no matter what the religion, whether it's Catholic or Eastern, you know, such as Buddhist or Taoist, that monks wake up somewhere around 3:15 to 3:30 in the morning, and that's when they do their breathing exercises, because you're not going to get that spiritual purity without it. So each breath we have should give us gratitude as well as lack of attachment. If we really experience the breath, we're ready to let it go. Wow, that was great. What a great breath. Okay, now I'll let that go so I can have another breath. All right, so that's the virtue of justice. Now, let's talk about when the ability to grieve, to contact everything and then retain only what is of value and release everything else back to the earth. When that is not happening, one of the things that happens is addiction. This comes when only the loss is focused on. The ability to see gain, to see what you have gained out of life. When that's not seen, then only the loss is seen. And the idea is that there's a perception of a big, empty hole or a void. And this desire to fill that void creates an over-attachment to filling this emptiness with some kind of gain. Now, this can take a number of different turns. It might be a physical addiction. This could be being addicted to food or being addicted to tobacco or to alcohol. It might be material objects, you know, accumulating more and more material objects as an addictive need to acquire things. The idea that since I've got this big empty hole inside me, if I just have more stuff, I'll be happier. And so this could be anything from the idea of shopping therapy. You know, you're feeling down, you're feeling glum, you're feeling like you don't have anything, that you've suffered a loss, and so let's go to the mall and buy some things as a way to cheer ourselves up. So it might mean obsessing over having the best car, the best house, the fanciest clothes, and so on. Or it may be an obsessive tendency to improve yourself, to try to prove yourself worth. When children suffer a difficult loss, such as the death of a parent, or the loss of a parent through divorce, they may blame themselves. If only I was a better child, Mommy and Daddy wouldn't have fought so much. Or maybe Daddy wouldn't have gone away if I was a better child, because, you know, then he would have been able to love me. You know, Daddy left because I wasn't a good child. And so this is, of course, not logical, but for a child trying to process a loss which doesn't fit their expectations. So we have this idea that we should be supported by our parents and supported on all levels, emotionally and otherwise, until we're able to deal with the world on our own. So if this happens, and if the child is unable and unsupported in processing the loss, they may spend the rest of their life trying to gain self-worth through achievement. So it doesn't have to be gaining material things or gaining weight or drunkenness through addictions like tobacco and alcohol. It can be being addicted to self-improvement. So taking yet another class to to or reading another self-help book to improve yourself. So not that self-improvement is a bad thing, but it's the motivation behind it. The reason for self-help and self-improvement is so that you can be more in alignment with your destiny and your walk with getting closer to your own divine nature and getting closer to God or closer to heaven. When it's undertaken to repair a defect or to fill an empty hole, then that's a process which is not likely to have any successful conclusion. So the rest of the life just may be spent trying to gain self-worth instead of simply accepting your innate self-worth by breathing in God. And that is, again, it's the addiction represents a loss of connection to the sacredness of breath. Because if that is there, then just the fact that the universe gave you breath means you have value, means you have merit. So here's some other thoughts or other words to describe this state of addiction as an inability to process loss effectively or process grief effectively. This leads to obsession over gain. It leads to obsessive behavior. It can lead to being materialistic. It can lead to boasting and posturing of trying to make yourself somebody you're not, you know, name dropping about how many people you know to impress people with how special you are. And, you know, in some sense, having an overinflated sense of vanity and concern for what people think of you. So addiction then represents focusing on future gain to compensate for past loss. Now, that's one category of distortion. Another big category is the idea of frailty. So this happens, this is like a sense of weakness. When we reject our rhythmic connection to God through the breath, we reject receiving anything of value, including life force, because that's the first thing we receive with the breath is our life force. If we believe that nothing of value can be retained or nothing of value can be held on to, we might end up rejecting everything so that we don't have to lose it. If you've suffered a terribly painful loss, then one strategy may be to never get close to anything again, never acknowledge anybody or anything as having value so that you don't have to take the chance of losing them as well. So, and this can be the loss of a loved one, as in passing away, or it might be the loss of a relationship, having an important relationship that ended badly and with disappointment, then may so wound the person that they decide to never engage in another relationship, just so that they don't have to suffer another loss, because there's this underlying belief that anything of value will be taken away. All right, so some of the ideas that this can lead to is, well, I said frailty, but this can also be just a sense of weakness, of not really manifesting anything out of the universe, or denying your needs and developing a sense of asceticism or asceticism, of really trying to be, you know, quite sterile and frugal in your existence, so you don't have much, so you don't have to worry about losing much. This can be running yourself down, self-deprecation, criticizing yourself to others, and just generally, you know, avoiding losing something. Well, you know, if I let people think well of me, then I'm going to disappoint them, and then I'll lose their appreciation. So I'll start out by deprecating myself so that they don't appreciate me and so that they don't think highly of me. The idea that you can't have anything of value is depressing, and so leading to being depressed is an aspect of this. And just simply being boring is the opposite of uninspiring. Somebody who doesn't expect anything out of life is going to be pretty low energy, and they're not going to have any plans, they're not going to have anything to talk about, they're just going to be boring people, actually. So Now, one of the ideas here of grief and this inability to accept the loss is the observation that life really can be poignant. Every moment of beauty is actually transient. Nothing's going to last forever. And sometimes it can fade quickly, even when it's really incredibly powerfully beautiful. The fall leaves are stunning, but they don't last for long, and then when they're gone, it takes a bit of faith to remember that spring will come again. So, and to take action based on that. So when your lawn is all cluttered with the fallen leaves, you know, instead of crying about the fallen leaves and sinking into depression, the best thing to do is go out and rake the leaves, and your lawn will be healthier for it next year if you do that. If you don't allow what's still living, the grass, to be covered with dead, rotting leaves, snuffing out the life force. And so the idea is that when we don't engage the grieving process, we don't clean up the leaves. We don't get rid of the stuff that is snuffing out our continued growth. So go out, make a compost, rake the leaves, make a compost pile, plant some bulbs for the spring, and then you can use the compost as fertilizer for next year. And that's really the imagery, is that the proper grieving puts stuff back into the earth so that new things can grow, and it is a process of renewal. All right, that brings us to the metal officials. The lung is the yin organ, and the more important of the two. It is the lung that receives the breath and hence gathers qi from the air. The lung then contacts the world directly and absorbs value. It defines a boundary between ourself and the world because we breathe the world into our lungs, and because the lungs also rule the skin. Now, by contrast, the wood is charged with managing our boundaries with the world by generating anger when our boundaries are transgressed, but the lungs define where we end and the universe begins. And that's important so that we can ask things of the universe. The large intestine is the other metal official, and it releases back to the earth that which is not of enduring value, while retaining the essence of life experience. Okay, so the lung is, as I said before, is the judge in terms of this metaphor of the courtly ministers. So the lung is charged physically with receiving and releasing the breath. And this is actually one of the driving forces of all body activities, including the making of qi. So it keeps our energy going, and that's important. And they also keep us in touch with the world and help us to react. And we think of that when something happens, we hold our breath, or we catch our breath, or we speed up on our breath to react to different circumstances. So the classical texts refer to the lungs as the minister from whom policies are issued or judgments are decreed. And this is the idea of assessing what's of value and then making a judgment and discerning a righteous or appropriate action. Now, in Chinese medicine, the functions of the lung are a short list of them is to exchange qi. And this is the idea of receiving pure qi or air qi from the universe. This is called prana in yoga theory. But also exchanging or releasing impure qi. So there's an idea of an energy exchange similar to what we think of as the gas exchange of absorbing oxygen and releasing carbon dioxide. But there is this sense of exchanging the pure for the impure in the lungs. And then the lungs play a role in transforming qi. And it is thought that the lungs blend the food energy, the qi energy from food, with the energy from the breath, from the air, to make the actual qi that the body can use. They rule the skin, and again, that's defining that boundary of where do I begin and where does the universe begin. And then a big function of the lungs is to generate grief. And one way I think of that is that in order to really be present to what's happening now, you have to actually surrender the past. You can't be living in the past or expecting something from the past to reappear. So this dissolving attachment or grieving the past is a natural function of the lung. The other thing is that the lung is said to house the corporeal soul or the bodily soul. And this is in essence the aspect of being alive, of having physicality. Even though we're talking about the emotions as being associated with each element, there's also another sense in which the lungs have an instinctive response to all seven emotions. So there is an aspect of that's really what it is to be alive, is to have feelings. That's how we can describe the state, is, oh, I felt like this and I felt like this in different situations. And then this same corporeal or bodily soul is actually released to the earth at death, the idea, and from the large intestine. So when the person dies, this aspect of the soul is said to leave the body through the large intestine and go back to the earth. Now, the primary job then of the lungs is contacting the world to absorb new value. Now, this ability to reach out with the lungs to draw the world in, so it's in a sense it's a reaching out, but it's a drawing in. This parallels one of the functions of the spleen, which is to reach out and take from the universe that which is rightfully ours, and then exhale what is not true or of value for our higher self. So this is really, in a transformational aspect, the job of the lung, to take from the universe and then what is ours, and then release that which is not ours and give it back. What is anything that is not serving our highest purpose, we should release. The idea of taking that which is rightfully yours refers to this sense of justice that is the virtue of the metal element and hence the virtue of the lungs. Taking from others is not rightfully yours, and not taking your share of life, not breathing in your quota of air, is also not honoring your own needs. And so it is this idea of the universe has something for me, but it's up to me to breathe it in, to draw it into my life, to manifest it. So some of the physical manifestations of lung imbalance, which can point to an imbalance in grief, and I mention this because I consider that many people have a backlog of unprocessed grief, and that is weakening their lungs. So physical weaknesses with imbalanced lung energy is shortness of breath, tiredness, cough, dry skin, constipation, and spontaneous sweating. So constipation is interesting, but the lungs are said to descend qi down to the large intestine to help them function. So if you have trouble with constipation, it may be actually a lung weakness. And then sweating refers to the phenomenon of sweating without exertion, of not being in an overly hot environment or not having worked up internal heat through exercise, and nonetheless just sweating. And this represents a failure of the lung energy to control the pores of the skin, and then you're just having spontaneous leaking, essentially. All right, so the mental issues that go along with imbalanced lung energy, and hence may come from unprocessed grief, is sadness and depression and obsessing about the future. The other official of the metal element is the large intestine. And I'm calling the large intestine the minister of sanitation because it is involved with the idea of transportation and elimination of the impure. So now the lungs are supposed to contact the world and retain that as what is of value. The large intestine assists in that because they retain fluids that you know, by the time the food matter has left the small intestine and gone to the large intestine, most of the nutrients have been absorbed, but there's still fluid that needs to be resorbed before the feces is eliminated. And so the fluid is an essential aspect of our yin nature, and so it does need to be resorbed. So that is something of value that the large intestine acts to actually retain. However, not everything we eat, again, is worth keeping. So the idea is that whatever we take in terms of our food, we want to absorb and keep all the nutrients and all the qi, but the fiber we can release to the earth. So, and the same thing applies in a more metaphoric sense. The experiences we have in life, we want to keep the nourishing aspects, keep the things that bring us value, but lose the emotional fiber that came along with that. So officially, the large intestine functions are to absorb fluids and eliminate the impure, and then they generate grief. And really, one of their aspects of that is to really do the letting go aspect of the grieving. So the primary job then is releasing the impure, and when the large intestine fails to release the impure, then everything starts to look like poo after a while, and you get negativity and cynicism as a result. So physically, the imbalance of large intestine is constipation and diarrhea and abdominal pain, but the psychological imbalances tend towards being stubborn and rigid and cynical and negative. All right. That leads us to some of the beliefs that then distort our ability to grieve. Now, again, this is governing our reactions to life situations, and that comes from our perceptions of life. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these perceptions that drive these beliefs, because how we perceive our needs and our relationship to the world and our expectations about the world are really fundamental behind some of these beliefs. And so with metal, again, the core thing is that the inability to accept divine will is the common theme. The need to ascribe blame for the painful experiences in life precludes the ability to experience new joy with each breath. So that implies that some of these imbalances will have underlying them the idea that life doesn't have any joy for me. You know, there isn't something else, or that this is the only thing the universe will give to me, or that I'll never have anything good again. I'll give some more specific belief systems, but that's the idea of that inability to experience new joy comes from a pessimism that there is anything else for you. And then the other, so that's the inability to actually accept things, and because either you don't believe the universe will provide you with more things, and because you're still attached to the losses of the past, or it represents perhaps a lack of self-worth, that you don't think you can deserve any gifts from the universe. So that's one aspect. The other big category is that the ability to release what is inessential or unessential is really important to the ability to receive. And so the lungs may share many beliefs with the spleen, as they both receive from the universe, and this inability to release the impure, if that's not seen as just part of the natural rhythm of life, then the healthy drive towards growth and purification, and those go hand in hand. We have to actually finish a process of growth and break up the leaves if we want our lawn to burst forth with full vigor and lushness in the spring. And so instead of just accepting that, oh, some things we let go and some things we get again, when one door closes, another one opens, then we have this obsessive need to prove ourselves through achievement, to prove our self-worth, or just obsessive need to fill an empty hole, and underneath that is the expectation that the hole really can't be filled. Alright, so with that, here's some of the common beliefs for metal. And again, some of these are subconscious. You may not resonate with having them, but they may actually be implied by behavior and actions. So, first one is that I've got to be in control, or I have to be in control. This is the idea that somebody's to blame for the loss you just suffered. And so the answer is, I better be in more control so that I don't suffer another loss. This is the inability to accept loss as inevitable and to do our best at processing once it happens. The other idea is that it's not safe to let go. It's not safe to surrender. And this, again, is also the idea that we, if we let go of this, we won't get anything else. Or is that I'm being suffocated, that because we feel like we can't breathe in, we feel like the world or maybe somebody in the world is suffocating us. But in many ways, this actually comes from our inability to let go of the past. So we're so full up with the past that we can't actually breathe in, and then we interpret the new experiences that the universe is trying to give to us as suffocation rather than as nourishment. I can't take in life. So the idea that you just aren't able to take in life, you aren't able to receive. Some of these are a bit parallel with some of the spleen beliefs from the earth element. I can't ask for what I want is a very common one that maybe I'll take it if the universe provides for me, but I'm not going to ask for anything. If you've suffered a lot of loss and you're lingering in that loss, you can't see what is beautiful in life. And so you focus on the loss, and sometimes this assigning blame may turn to God. So God is punishing me as a belief system. I can't have any control. So the idea that if you suffered a loss, you may face the idea of that it happened despite you, but then go into a state of resignation, that rather than processing the loss and then picking yourself up and moving forward, you stay stuck in the idea of that there isn't anything more to be had, and that the way to prevent any future losses is to have control. And yet, if you had control, you wouldn't have suffered the loss. So the loss then reinforces this idea that you don't have any control. And in a sense, that's true, but we can obsess over the idea of that. So I'm not able to receive, or I'm not worthy of receiving. Again, that's the function of the lungs to reach out and grasp from the universe that which is rightfully yours. Or if you feel like you're too full up because you haven't let go of the past, then life is overwhelming, or, you know, I'm in overwhelm. Perhaps it is the idea of the coping with a difficult loss in the past by resolving never to have anything of value in the future. So, and this can be a belief that nothing of value can be retained, so don't get attached. Or a denial that there is anything of value in life, so just nothing has any value, which leads to the idea that life is pointless, or I'm worthless. You know, if you're so blocked up in receiving, often because you're attached to the past, then life does seem pointless, and you do seem worthless. Like I said, people with weak lung energy and weak ability to let go of the past tend to be boring because they're not present. They're living in some other time zone. I don't deserve anything. I'll never have enough speaks to these addictive and obsessive tendencies of accumulation, as well as I'll never be good enough. All right, so that's a few of them. Another one of the response to the scariness of looking at the painful emotions is that I have to be strong. And this is an excuse that's often used to deny or avoid the grieving process, you know, maybe for somebody else. So, well, I've got to be strong for my children, or I've got to be strong for my partner, or I've got to be strong for my universe or my community. So, but this is actually a dishonoring of your own need to grieve. And so the idea that because the loss highlights your essential powerlessness, then the reflex action is to try to claim as much strength as possible by avoiding looking further at the grief. All right, so those are some of the ideas on grief. I hope I've made it more interesting than just the process of crying, that underlying that is the aspect of our natural rhythm of life is to sift through our mine shaft of experience and return the dirt back to the earth, but look for, find, and keep the nuggets of gold and the pearls of wisdom, and that this is a process that must be done in order to keep ourselves clear of mind and clear of purpose and clear of body. Thank you for joining me.